everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Big E here. This is episode 96 of Law for Virginia Law Enforcement Officers. What do you need to know to protect your community, serve your community, about the law in the Commonwealth of Virginia? And today, I want to keep talking about ECO and TDO law. And in particular, I want to talk about use of force regarding ECO and TDOs. I've been gone for a little bit. Sorry, I've been traveling. But it is good to get back and dive into things. And the last few episodes, you know, we've been talking about responses to mental health incidents, people in crisis, uses of force. In episode 94, we talked about that deadly force case from North Carolina, which was Allman versus Charlotte. That's the case where the court refused to find summary judgment and found that the officers may have used unlawful deadly force when shooting a person who was who was in crisis. Then in the last episode, we talked about the legal standards for ECO and TDO. Today, I want to start talking about the standards for the use of force by a law enforcement officer in Virginia, especially for an ECO or a TDO. That is to say, how do the courts judge an officer's use of force when taking somebody into custody who hasn't committed any crime at all, but nevertheless, the officer has probable cause, the person has a mental illness, and there's a substantial likelihood that as a result of the mental illness, the person in the near future will cause serious physical harm to himself or others by reason, as evidenced by recent behavior or attempting or threatening harm and other relevant information, or suffer serious harm due to the lack of capacity to protect himself from harm or provide for his basic human needs, and probable cause to believe the person's in need of hospitalization or treatment, and probable cause to believe the person is unwilling or incapable, of volunteering for hospitalization or treatment. So when you have probable cause of that, and yet you don't have probable cause that a person has committed a crime at all, then what kind of force is a court going to find to be lawful and appropriate? That's the question here. And a great way, I think, to look at how a court would judge this in 2023 is to look at a recent case from August from the Court of Appeals where an officer was convicted of battery under 18.257 in the city of Alexandria at a jury trial, and he appealed to the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals affirmed that conviction in August, and that case is Griffin versus Commonwealth, which is a ruling from August 1st of 2023. And I want to talk about that case first and then step back and talk about what is the law then regarding the use of force by an officer in an ECO or TDO situation, both, by the way, as far as criminal law and as far as civil law, because we're going to see it's basically the same. It's just that the standards are a little bit stricter, obviously, in criminal law. So diving into the Alexandria case first, this is a case where a police officer was prosecuted for battery, misdemeanor battery under 18.257, for an assault on a detainee who was being subject to a detention order and being brought to the hospital. This was an ECO detainee, and the defendant in this case was an Alexandria police officer who brought a detainee to the hospital, brought him to the registration desk. And at the time, the detainee was in handcuffs. Now, when the detainee began to pull back and resist the officer's control, the detainee had his hands kept behind his back. The officer gave him commands to stop resisting and then grabbed the detainee with both of his hands and used his right leg to sweep the detainee's legs out from under him. And so again, the detainee, who was handcuffed behind his back, fell face first in the hospital floor, sustained some facial injuries, and broke his kneecap. And at trial, the officer testified that he thought the detainee was putting him in a position where he could assault him. Although the officer did, you know, admit on the stand that he didn't react properly, he intended to use a technique other than a leg sweep to bring him to the ground. But that was his testimony, that he was concerned. The detainee, he knew, had bipolar disorder. He testified that he was aware the detainee had made several threats to government installations and had a previous conviction for arson. He knew that he had assaulted a nurse in the past. He had assaulted a deputy at a mental health hospital in the past. And he had physically confronted firefighters in the past. Now, in this particular night, when he's got the detainee in custody, the detainee hadn't made any verbal threats toward hospital staff. He hadn't tried to bite or spit anybody. But at trial, the officer sought to introduce several pieces of evidence concerning the detainee's mental health history and his aggressive behavior in the past from various sources, including an incident at another hospital in the previous year and several incidences that had taken place in the past. And as also some incidents that took place after this as well, interestingly, because obviously this detainee, got taken into custody again after this incident. The defendant argued that the history of the detainee's mental health history, his history of violence, and his history of resentment and hostility against first responders and hospital staff was admissible because it was relevant to the officer's decision to use force. The trial court, though, excluded the proffered evidence about his history and also the actions that the detainee took, his violence after this incident. But he did allow the defendant himself to testify about what he knew at the time about the detainee's mental health and behavioral history that informed and affected his decisions that day. So in other words, things that he didn't know about or details he didn't know about, he couldn't testify to or put on evidence about. Things that hadn't happened yet, he couldn't testify about. But things that he knew about at the time, he could testify to that. And then at trial, the court gave an instruction to the jury on what is battery, right? 18.257. And the instruction to the jury said the defendant was charged with assault and battery. Kummel has to prove that the defendant had the officer willfully touched the detainee without legal justification or excuse, and the touching was done in an angry, rude, insulting, or vengeful manner. And if you find that the defendant, the officer, had legal excuse or justification to touch the detainee, but that the force used during the touching was excessive, then you shall find him guilty of assault and battery. And if not, then you shall find him not guilty. So the jury read this instruction and said, well, we don't really understand, because it seems like even if the officer touched him without legal justification or excuse, if the force was not excessive, we don't find him guilty. They were confused. So anyway, the trial court wrote back to the jury and said, whether the touching was done without legal justification or excuse, or if there was legal justification or excuse, but the force was excessive, then no matter what, the Commonwealth has to prove the touching was done in an angry, rude, insulting, or vengeful manner. That's the key of what 18.257 requires you to prove. And so the jury convicted the officer, and the officer appealed. So the Court of Appeals looked at a couple of different issues in this case. The first was the evidence that the trial court excluded about the detainee's history, the stuff that the officer maybe didn't know about, the details of the events where the detainee had been violent in the past or been aggressive or threatening in the past, and also the incidents that took place after this where the detainee continued to be, violent and threatening and so on. And the court said that in this case, this really wasn't a self-defense case. If it had been a self-defense case, then we could have maybe gotten more into the detainee's history. But here, the entirety of the detainee's mental health history and criminal record were not relevant to whether the use of force was reasonable here. The question is, if the officer's use of force was objectively reasonable based on the facts that any reasonable officer would know at the scene, based on what he knew at the scene, what would any reasonable officer have done is the standard. And so what he knew at the scene is the focus of the analysis, right? If any reasonable officer knew what he did at the time, then what would be a justifiable use of force? And so testimony from other people about their experiences with the detainee and other people's knowledge of the behavior don't bear on the reasonability of this particular officer's decision because they didn't inform his actions that day. Instead, again, the jury was perfectly appropriately heard the evidence that about what the officer himself knew about the detainee's past. The next issue that the court looked at, though, was, what is it that you have to prove to convict an officer of unlawful battery when using force against a detainee in a case like this. And here, the court said the key is to look at what the trial court ultimately clarified when the jury asked this question, right? The original instruction was probably a little confusing. But in the clarifying instruction that the trial court gave to the jury, the trial court clearly and unequivocally instructed the jury that regardless of whether the jury found that the defendant used excessive force, the Commonwealth still has to prove that the touching is done in an angry, rude, insulting, or vengeful manner. So this is important, I think, because what that does is it brings the focus back from, does the jury not like the amount of force or think the force was excessive, right? Which would almost create a new form of a battery that only law enforcement officers could be convicted of, right? You couldn't convict a civilian of using excessive force, but you could only convict a law enforcement officer. And that's not in the text of 18.257. It's not in the common law history. So the court says here, the trial court brings it back and says, look, it doesn't matter whether, you know, this is not a jury question of whether the force is excessive or not. The question is the touching done in an angry, rude, insulting, or vengeful manner, just like in any other assault and battery case? And if it is, and it doesn't have legal justification or excuse, in other words, the officer didn't have a legal justification for using the force, then the defendant's guilty, the officer's guilty of assault and battery. And the court agreed in this case that the officer was using force in a manner that constituted an unlawful battery, because this case, the court found, was not one where the force was justified or excused, and therefore it was unlawful. The court agreed that the reasonableness of a use of force by a police officer is evaluated from the objective perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene, allowing for officers to make split-second judgments in circumstances that are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving about the amount of force that is necessary. And if that phrasing is interesting or familiar to you, it should be. Here, the court is quoting Graham versus Connor, which is interesting because Graham versus Connor is a Section 1983 federal case about federal statutory law, and this is a decision involving Virginia common law. And yet you see that the court is using the same language. And in this case, the court noted that the detainee, who was handcuffed and in the defendant's custody, the officer's custody, hadn't made any attempts to flee custody. He hadn't made any threatening movements towards any hospital staff or any patients. In fact, he'd been compliant this night until the officer forced him to move a few steps closer to the registration counter. And the detainee refused that. And ultimately, remember, going back to the beginning, that's why he gets swept and thrown on the floor, is the detainee refuses to make the steps towards the registration counter that the officer orders him to do. So a criminal case, officers convicted of battery, from the Virginia Court of Appeals from August. So notice in this case, we don't have any discussion of qualified immunity. We don't have any discussion here of the Graham versus Connor, or, by the way, even the new statutes that were enacted by the General Assembly in the 2020 session. That's because all of this took place before any of those statutes took effect. And qualified immunity is only a defense under a lawsuit in federal law, a civil lawsuit, for example, a violation of 42 U.S.C. 1983, the Federal Civil Rights Act. So we don't have qualified immunity in Virginia under Virginia law. It doesn't exist. What do we have? We have the common law theories of battery, false imprisonment, and gross negligence. And we've talked about this in other episodes before, but it's important to note that we don't have an excessive force statute under Virginia law. Now, we're going to see in a minute that there is a statute the General Assembly passed in one of their special sessions, one of their criminal justice reforms special sessions in 2020. And that statute does define for the first time what excessive force is. And spoiler alert, they just use Graham versus Connor. So it's pretty straightforward and easy to understand. But it doesn't necessarily come right out and say it modifies criminal law. And even if it does, and I think we're going to look at this and conclude, yeah, it kind of does inform the criminal law analysis. The Court of Appeals in the Griffin case makes clear that battery is not synonymous with excessive force. They're not the same thing. And that the core of battery is what it always is, right? Battery, criminal battery, civil battery, is touching another person without consent and without legal justification in a rude, angry, vengeful manner. And so if an officer is found to have touched somebody without legal justification or excuse, without consent, it still doesn't answer the question is the touching done in an angry, rude, insulting, or vengeful manner? If it's not done in an angry, rude, insulting, or vengeful manner, then it's not battery, regardless of whether it was excessive or not. Virginia is a common law jurisdiction. That means that the law of King James of England, as it was in effect at the time of the founding of the Commonwealth, before the founding of the United States, is still in effect. And in fact, there's a statute, one of the first statutes passed in the General Assembly when the code was written, says the law of King James of England is still in effect in Virginia. So if you look at 18.257, the statute itself for battery, you won't find the phrase angry, rude, insulting, or vengeful manner. All of that comes from the common law. All that comes from the law of King James of England, the English law that we brought over, which is not unusual. You won't find a definition of larceny in the Virginia Code either. If you look up 18.295, 18.296, you'll find a punishment for larceny, but you won't find a definition of larceny. If you look up embezzlement, right, you won't find, the embezzlement law. There's a lot of common law available, although embezzlement is a statutory offense. That has more of a definition than larceny does. So a lot of times people like to charge larceny because it's a common law offense instead of embezzlement, which is a statutory offense. Statutory burglary is called statutory burglary because the definition of burglary is in that code section. And that's a distinction from common law burglary, which is we have a punishment for, but burglary itself, common law burglary, is a common law offense. So it had to be at night, and there had to be a breaking, it had to be a residence, and so on. Statutory burglary can be during the day. It can be without a breaking. It can be of a storehouse or of an office building, that kind of thing. So we have common law offenses and we have statutory offenses in Virginia. Battery is a common law offense. And an example is a case from the Virginia Supreme Court in January of 2020 called Cromer T. versus Billings. And we talked about this case, I think, a long time ago, like maybe literally 90 episodes ago, when we were first talking about use of force. But Cromer T. versus Billings is a case where an officer stops a woman for speeding. She refused to get out of her car when the officer demands that she get out. The officer then forcibly removed her from her car and injured her. And the court, when they examined whether it was proper for the jury to find the officer liable, civilly liable for battery, explains that there's no statute that authorizes officers to commit wrongful acts. Police officers are under the legal obligation and duty to confine their acts to those that they are legally authorized to perform under the law. And so the Virginia Supreme Court explains, if officers exceed their authority or violate their duty, they act at their own risk and the state is not responsible. I want you to remember that language. As we talk about the impact of the ECO and TDO statutory language, as we talk about the impact of the 2020 changes to the Virginia Code, note that this language is really important. Remember what battery is, common law battery. The definition is really crucial. And again, even in the case from August, where the officer is tried and convicted of battery, the court focuses on these two elements of battery, that you're touching a person without their consent and without legal justification, and that your touching is done in an angry, rude, insulting, or vengeful manner. So notice here, what in the Cromer T. case the court is focusing on first is, do you have a legal justification for the touching? And if you exceed your legal justification, that is to say you violate your duty, you do something that you don't have lawful authority to do, then you are exposing yourself to liability for civil battery and indeed possible prosecution for actual criminal battery. And so in the Cromer T. case, the court finds there's no protection for the officer by sovereign immunity. And we'll talk about sovereign immunity for a second. And here the officer was violating clear settled law that he didn't have the authority to just pull somebody out of the car for basically 12 seconds of noncompliance. The officer's actions constituted willful and wanton misconduct taken in violation of the woman's rights. And again, I'm not talking, we can go back and talk about the facts of Cromer T versus Billings in detail. And it's worth, I think, just going back and listening to the original podcast if you want to about this case. But the court's language here is what I want to focus on. And we'll talk about sovereign immunity in a little in a future episode. And I think we've talked about it in the other episodes before. But I think that the key language to focus on here is why the officer was found to be liable for battery, right? He's doing something that he doesn't have the lawful justification for. Now, the court really struggled in the Cromer T case to define how do we judge whether an officer's actions are excessive, use of force is excessive or not. And here in Cromer T, it was pretty clear that the violence of the officer was excessive. The person was talking on their phone. She was refusing to talk to the officer. He asked her to step out of the car. She refused. It's about 12 seconds of noncompliance for a speeding case. She just won't get out of the car. And so the officer pulls her out of the car and throws her on the ground after, again, about 12 seconds of noncompliance. And, you know, here the court says it's pretty clear that that's an unlawful use of force. But it begs the question, in a closer case, how would you judge whether or not somebody's, whether or not officer's use of force was lawful or not? And Cromer T happened, the Cromer T case is decided in January of 2020. In the fall of 2020, the General Assembly for the first time defines what excessive force is under Virginia law. And we never had a definition before of excessive force under Virginia law. Now, 19.283.6 clearly defines excessive force, and it states, excessive force means force that is objectively unreasonable given the totality of the circumstances, including the severity of the crime at issue, number two, whether the suspect poses an immediate threat to the safety of officer or others, and number three, whether the suspect is actively resisting arrest or attempting to evade arrest by flight. And that should seem familiar to you, because that is the definition of excessive force from Graham versus Connor. So the General Assembly adopted the standard that you, as officers, have known your whole careers probably, which is a standard that we have a lot of law about, and we've talked about this podcast extensively. So we know sort of what the legal standard is. We know that in Virginia law, you could be found liable for battery. And we also know, of course, the standard for civil liability under federal law. That's 42 U.S.C. 1983, which provides that if you use force that is not lawful, if you use unreasonable amount of force, that you could face civil liability. And the standard for non-deadly force is the Graham versus Connor standard we just talked about. The standard for deadly force, of course, is Tennessee versus Garner. Does the officer have probable cause to believe the person poses an immediate threat of death or serious bodily injury to you or somebody else? And that was the focus of the Allman case that we talked about two episodes ago in episode 94. So now we got a kind of a sense of what the legal standards are, right? We know in Virginia, you could face liability for battery. You could face prosecution for battery. Under federal law, you could face liability under 42 U.S.C. 1983 for either the use of non-deadly force, that would be a Graham versus Connor, or deadly force, Tennessee versus Garner, like we did in the Allman case. Now, I also mentioned that you could face liability for negligence. You can't face liability for negligence under federal law as a state officer, but you could face liability for negligence under Virginia law as a law enforcement officer if you were acting as a law enforcement officer, taking somebody to custody or transporting somebody or using force against somebody in ECO or TDO. And negligence, there's a situation where you might be using force lawfully, but you would face liability because you used it in a way that caused injury, basically accidentally, right? You maybe applied a force technique improperly. Now, in the Cromer T versus Billings case, it's not an issue because the person willfully uses the force that he is not authorized to use. But when you are using force as a government officer in Virginia, you are taking an action as a government officer, just like any other government officer, bus driver, VDOT driver during a snowstorm, school administrator trying to figure out how to handle a school disciplinary issue. You're taking an action as a government officer, and as such, you have something called sovereign immunity. Now, before you get excited, sovereign immunity isn't immunity at all. It's just basically what it says is there's a higher standard for proving negligence in order to find liability for negligence if it's a government actor. Normal negligence, as if you're just driving your police car around and you're just driving, just you know, on routine patrol, you're not responding to a call or anything like that, and all of a sudden the light changes, you don't notice it because you're listening to, you know, this podcast, and you crash into somebody in front of you, you're going to face liability for that just like any other motorist are. You're not doing any special government action. You're just driving a car. That's going to be ordinary negligence. But if we ask you to respond lights and sirens to a call, we're asking you to take an especially higher risk. If we're asking you to use force against somebody in a dangerous way, we're asking you to do something that we don't normally ask regular citizens to do. And so because of that, if you're going to face liability for negligence, the standard is going to be higher for the person bringing the lawsuit. They're basically going to have to prove that there was willful and wanton negligence, that is to say, action undertaken in conscious disregard for someone else's rights, or with reckless indifference to consequences that you were aware of from existing circumstances and conditions, that your conduct would probably cause injury to somebody else. Because we asked you to take this risk. We asked you to use this force. We asked you to drive lights and sirens. And as it turns out, you know, sovereign immunity is used more often by non-law enforcement people. It's used by VDOT drivers driving, you know, putting down salt during snowstorms, garbage truck drivers who spill, you know, grease on a sidewalk, which causes somebody to fall. Ambulance drivers, right? They run lights and code all the time. School bus drivers, you know, a child gets hurt or something. These are the kinds of government workers that use sovereign immunity all the time. Officers, police officers, less so. But that's the standard for negligence. You're not going to be found, you know, nobody's going to sit there and, you know, nickel and dime, oh, you should have used this handcuffing technique this way and not that way and so on. You're doing something risky because we asked you to do it. So notice here that in all of these situations, we're finding ourselves coming back to this basic question of the question that was raised in Cromartie versus Billings, which is, okay, so is an officer's action in using force, is the officer's action in taking a person into custody or using force to enforce that custody, is that something that's authorized by law or is it not authorized by law? If it's not authorized by law, then the officer's going to face liability for battery or potential criminal prosecution for battery. And so really what that does is it begs the question of, in any case where you're taking somebody into custody for an ECO or a TDO, do you have probable cause to believe that the person has a mental illness and there exists a substantial likelihood that as a result of that mental illness, the person will cause serious physical harm to themselves or others, or suffer serious physical harm due to the lack of capacity to protect themselves from harm or provide for their basic human needs, or that you have probable cause, in addition, that the person's in need of hospitalization or treatment. And lastly, do you have probable cause the person's unwilling to volunteer or incapable of volunteering for hospitalization or treatment? Those are all the requirements in the code. If you don't have probable cause of those things, then you may not be authorized to use any force at all. If you do have probable cause, how much force can you use, right? Well, we know basically that whether or not your force is excessive or not, whether we're under Virginia law or federal law now, is defined by Graham versus Connor, right? What's the severity of the crime at issue? Is the person, which is almost always going to be zero because there is no crime, but is the person resisting or evading, and are they an immediate threat to you or somebody else? And as it turns out, there are a few cases where the courts have dealt with that. And that's what I want to talk about in the next episode is the probable cause for an ECO and a TDO and probable cause for the ECO and TDO and the reasonableness of the use of force in an ECO or TDO situation. But that's going to have to be next episode. For today, that's all from me. That's all from Big E. Stay safe and don't get captured. See you next time.